I've always looked to the police for protection, and I really did not expect to have that violence.
Iraq was hit by a rocket. The bus was parked. The passengers were getting in. It was near a bridge.
And a missile hit a building close to the road and caused the car to overturn. Her 2.5-year-old daughter had glass wings to her head. She had 2 broken legs. Her sister was suffering from severe bleeding.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, March 25th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Any hopes of a joyful liberation of a grateful Iraq by U.S. and British armies are evaporating fast in the Euphrates Valley as a sense of bitterness germinated from blood spilled and humiliations endured begins to grow in the hearts of invaded and invader alike. Attempts by U.S. Marines to take bridges over the river Euphrates have become bogged down in casualties and troops taken prisoner. The Marines, in turn, have responded harshly. Out in the plain west of the city, Marines shepherding a gigantic series of convoys north towards Baghdad have reacted to ragged sniping with an aggressive series of house searches and arrests. A surgical assistant at the Saddam Hospital in Nasiriyah, interviewed at a Marine checkpoint outside the city, said that on Sunday, half an hour after 2 dead Marines were brought into the hospital, U.S. aircraft dropped what he described as 3 or 4 cluster bombs on civilian areas, killing 10 and wounding 200. Joe Wilding is a law student and human rights observer in central Baghdad who is documenting the war. Wilding sent an email back to the U.S. describing the scene yesterday at the Al-Kindi Hospital. Her email quoted the experiences of people in Baghdad living through the war. A woman she met in the hospital said, quote, "We are farmers, we are farmers," the woman kept repeating through her rage and grief and incomprehension while the orderlies mopped the blood from the floor, picked up the rags of clothing torn and then cut from the body. Her name is Rasha. She's a 19-year-old college student and she was wounded in the head and arm. Someone asked her what she wanted to do when she graduated. Through a translator, she said, "Bush has killed my dream. How should I think of the future?" Peace Watch spoke with Joe Wilding this morning from Baghdad.
Today has been very strange in Baghdad. The sky has been thick with dust and smoke and debris. There's been a massive wind and it's just thrown all sorts of stuff up into the air. There's a lot of smoke around. And in fact, at about 4:30, 5 o'clock, the sky went more or less dark. The sun was blotted out completely. The air has been terrible all day. In this part of Baghdad, it's very quiet. All the shops are closed, bricked up, boarded up, covered with metal shutters. In other parts of Baghdad, life is still carrying on much more normally in the poorer areas. Saddam City, for example, is still buzzing.
Mm-hmm.
But in this part of town, it's very quiet. Nobody's going to work. Nobody's going out. Nothing is open.
Have many people left Baghdad to flee to other areas?
There are people who have gone to Syria and Jordan. Those who could get out of the country left a while ago. Other people have left Baghdad to go to outlying farm areas because they felt that it would be safer there.
Mm-hmm. And who were the people that were able to leave? How can you describe? I would imagine that they're the ones that have a means. Have some sort of means to leave.
Generally, it's the wealthier people who have left the country. People who have relatives in outlying areas have managed to get out of the city, but there are still millions and millions of people in Baghdad.
And how are they defending themselves?
Really, people are not defending themselves. They've got food stored, they've got water stored, as long as they're able to afford those things. People have dug wells. The food ration has been given out as far ahead as July, so people have stores of rice and flour and lentils and basic things like that. As long as they didn't have to sell those rations to buy other things. And there's a street where people do sell their rations because they need other essentials like medicine, or shoes, or transport to hospitals, for example. And so there are some people who are completely unprepared in a very precarious position. there are a lot of people who have guns. Not everyone by any means, but a lot of people. And most men in Iraq, almost all men in Iraq, have done military service, so they know how to fire a gun. But people say to us, you hold a gun when you're a child in Iraq. The women know how to hold a gun. And so there are a fair number of armed people in the city.
So what can you tell us about whether or not there are civilian casualties there in Baghdad?
We met a family yesterday in the Al-Kindi Hospital in Baghdad. They came into the emergency room while we were visiting some other people in the hospital. Their house had been hit by a rocket, and the entire upper story of the house had been completely wiped out. There were three people killed, two women and a young girl, and there were many injuries, shrapnel injuries, fractures, and they were very, very traumatized. We went today to the house, and the neighbors were talking about having seen a couple of planes overhead. Three rockets were fired, and one of them hit the house. The brother of one of the men who was injured was standing perhaps about 20 meters away when it happened. He said he ran to the house, and they all helped to try and get people out from the rubble. One of the people killed was the wife of another person who was injured. They'd only been married for a week, and the young man in the hospital was absolutely distraught. He broke down. He was on the floor in tears. He was desperate. There were other people in the hospital. There was one woman who had been driving out of Baghdad to get to somewhere safe, and a missile hit a building close to the road and caused the car to overturn. Her 2.5-year-old daughter had glass wounds to her head. She had 2 broken legs. Her sister was suffering from severe bleeding. We know that in the last couple of days, another house has been destroyed in the Admir district. These stories just keep on coming in.
How is it that these houses are being hit when the U.S. military is insisting that they are only going to target military facilities?
Seeing the farmhouse that was hit today, I really can't explain it in terms of a military target. There was no military target nearby. The whole area was just small farms, small farmhouses, a couple of fields and a house, a couple more fields and a house. There was nothing nearby that could explain it missing its target. The only conclusion that I can come to is that it was deliberately targeted. The plane was flying overhead and it dropped a bomb. I can't see any way that it could have been aiming for something that was a legitimate target and missed. But in any case, if there is a legitimate military target within a civilian area, it ceases to be a legitimate target if you can't hit it without harming the civilian populations. And the children in the nearby houses suffered bleeding ears as a result of the explosion. And all of the houses in the surrounding area were destroyed. These missiles are not as precise as the U.S. military would like you to think.
You're saying houses nearby that farm that was bombed were also destroyed?
They were damaged. Their windows were all broken, and some of them have bad cracks in them. We also saw a group of 3 houses yesterday. The middle one had been destroyed, and the ones either side had bad cracks and were structurally unsound. And when you see other buildings that have been bombed, say you see a ministry, and all the houses around it have broken windows. The thing is that this is a city. It's not that military targets have been put in the middle of civilian areas. It's a city where there are houses and then there are government buildings. And all of these things coexist within the same space. It's not possible to attack one without damaging another. And a lot of the buildings here are structurally unsound because they've been weakened by successive bombings. And also, during 12.5 years of sanctions, people haven't had the money to keep their houses in good repair. So there are a lot of structurally unsound buildings in this town.
Have any of the hospitals or schools or any of the other structures there in the town been hit? Have you been to the hospitals at all?
None of the hospitals I've been to have been hit. I haven't heard any confirmed reports of hospitals being damaged. one of the men who works in the internet center said that one of the colleges in the university was hit, and that's close to where he lives, and that it had damaged, I think, only the fence of a primary school.
Joe Wilding, a British law student in Baghdad, to document civilian casualties. We lost our telephone line with her in mid-sentence, but she ended her email writing, quote, "My thoughts are with the family back in the hospital, back in Baghdad, after the sanctuary they fled to turned out to be no such thing. They have to endure another night hearing the bombs fall, feeling the world shake, knowing how it is when one hits close enough to collapse the walls around you, not knowing where the other family members are," unquote. Thanks to Peace Watch editor Lona Elias for that segment. Reports on the number of U.S. military casualties in Iraq have filled the news, but very little has been reported on Iraqi civilian casualties. The Iraq Body Count Project is a team working to change that. They're documenting the number of Iraqi civilian casualties and posting their findings on their website, www.iraqbodycount.org. Earlier today, we spoke with one member of the project, Mark Harold, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of New Hampshire.
I've been involved in doing this kind of thing since October of 2001, when I began putting together the story as to what was happening on the ground in Afghanistan, and have kept up doing that to this very day. There's an updated database available on what's been happening on the ground in Afghanistan in terms of civilian casualties and arrests, abductions, and so on and so forth.
Tell us about the Iraq Body Count Project and the developments of the war in Iraq to date.
I think most people would argue that the likelihood of very, very high levels of civilian casualties is great in Iraq. And this because what we're looking at, and I suspect this will begin tonight, is a urban scene. Urban warfare. We know that urban warfare is extremely costly in terms of civilians and military, and civilians and military from both sides. The model, I think, which we can look at as a predictor is the struggle which has been waged between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which is largely urban, and the record is, I think, quite clear that this is very, very costly to civilians, and it's very costly to the military of both sides. In some ways, this is the worst dream, the worst scenario for Mr. Rumsfeld and General Franks and others to be sucked into urban warfare, and yet we see exactly that happening as we speak in the south of Iraq, around Basra and in Basra, and even in a relatively little town such as Qasr.
Why is this such a nightmare scenario, as you call it?
Well, you start firing tank shells and dropping bombs and firing multiple multiple barrel rocket launchers and the like in urban areas, you kill a lot of people. This is very different from Iraq in 1991, where most of the combat was out in the desert and fairly deserted areas, and therefore relatively few civilians perished. If we look at the modern wars of the 1990s and the year 2000, we find something which is quite amazing taking place. And again, this is one of the well-kept secrets in some sense of these modern wars. We find that the more precision bombs are used, relatively speaking, so, you know, for example, in Iraq 1, about 7% of the bombs and missiles were so-called precision weaponry, 93% weren't. When we go to Afghanistan, we find that over 60% of the bombs and missiles were precision-guided. We would expect, therefore, to find fewer civilian casualties, and in fact, exactly the reverse is the case. The level on a sort of prorated basis of civilian casualties in Afghanistan was much higher than in Yugoslavia and was in turn much higher than in Iraq 1.
So the precision bombs aren't so precise after all?
Well, they are certainly more precise than the bombs which were used in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. What has happened is that political and military elites make decisions to bomb certain targets in what I like to call civilian-rich areas. And when you bomb these targets in civilian-rich areas with bombs of enormous destructive capability, such as, say, the 2,000-pound bomb, which, by the way, is the bomb of choice these days. It was also the bomb of choice in the Afghan campaign in the latter period of the Afghan campaign. It still is. The 2,000-pound bomb kills everybody within a 120-meter radius. It also has a 13 to 30-meter error radius. And, you know, I can go on and talk more about technical things, but the point is that these bombs are enormously powerful, and they also have margins of error, as, you know, as announced by the producers of the bombs and recognized by the Pentagon. To be entirely safe from a 2,000-pound bomb, according to none other than Admiral Stufflebeam, who was very involved in the Afghan campaign, of course. Mr. Stufflebeam himself acknowledged after the friendly fire incident in December of 2001 that to be really safe from the fragmentation of a 2,000-pound bomb, you had to be at least 1,000 meters away.
And that's pretty hard to do in an urban area.
That's the point.
And so when you said that you think we're headed in this direction tonight, are you referring to the advancement of the troops into Baghdad?
Well, into the suburbs, presumably, of Baghdad. And this is going to be a very, very difficult battle. It'll be a very costly battle on everything, people, infrastructure, and the like. You know, what I've been reading, and, you know, I'm reading basically what everybody else has access to, that, you know, Mr. Hussein has positioned his crack troops in and around Baghdad, and so we're really talking about the Battle of Baghdad, and presumably north of Baghdad, you know, the Battle of Mosul and the Battle of Tikrit and so on. You know, this is going to be, you know, very, very costly. I think up until now it hasn't been that costly in Baghdad itself in terms of civilian lives because Baghdad, unlike Kabul, Baghdad has very large government buildings in relatively open spaces. That was not the case in Kabul. And so these buildings, as we saw on TV, we saw these amazing explosions and fires and so on and so forth, located in these relatively, areas relatively distant from, you know, high-density civilian populations. I think that's going to change. And, you know, when the fighting begins street to street, then a lot of people die.
Professor Harold, what can you tell us about what we might expect to hear or see as a result of civilian casualties in this war?
Well, I think it depends who you listen to. that was one of the reasons I originally began doing this work, was I was terribly dissatisfied with the level of and the quality of discourse in this country in October of 2001. I suspect that, you know, we will continue, that will continue that trend, that the mainstream media is going to largely stay away from this topic, although I think it's going to be more difficult here because of the imagery which comes in, and there's a significant number of independent reporters who are not embedded with the troops who I think are going to do their job, namely report what they see. And this is going to come out of Basra and Qasr and Mosul and Tikrit and so on. And, you know, we're going to see, I think, the same kind of things we saw in Afghanistan happening. I mean, let me just mention a couple instances here because I think it will give you a taste of what has been happening. I mean, a poor Jordanian fellow got out of his car in Baghdad on the first night and wanted to go to a phone booth, and a bomb fell and he's dead. The museum in Tikrit, we have a picture of the museum in Tikrit with a huge gaping hole in it. This was not a military target. Yesterday, a Syrian bus in a city on the western part of Iraq was hit by a rocket. The bus was parked. The passengers were getting in. It was near a bridge, and at least five people died, and many others were injured. This is what we're going to be seeing and seeing more of and hearing more about. There are many, many photos available showing the destruction of homes. There's a large tourist center on the Tigris River in Baghdad. It has been completely flattened. This is an installation of absolutely no military significance whatsoever. And this is what I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of. As the bombing and the war approaches, areas of greater population density.
Mark Harold is an associate professor of economics at the University of New Hampshire, and he's also helped to put together the www.iraqbodycount.org website. Contrary to what the United Nations had previously predicted, no major exodus of Iraqis to neighboring Jordan has taken place yet. Astonishingly enough, thousands of Iraqis who live and work in Iraq's western neighbor are actually heading back home as the bombing increases. Ula Farawadi has more from Amman, Jordan.
The six-day U.S.-led war on Iraq has compelled thousands of Iraqis who had sought refuge in Jordan after the 1991 war to go back to Iraq. Jordan's Foreign Minister Marwan Muasher said today 5,200 Iraqis have crossed the border since March 15. Among them is Haider, a 30-year-old Shiite who boarded a bus that will take him back to Baghdad.
I don't care if Saddam Hussein was against Shiites in the 1991 war. All I know is that I have an obligation to go back and defend my country. I have to go help my brother, who is also fighting in Iraq. This is a war of dignity, and we have to defend our dignity.
At least 300,000 Iraqis live in Jordan. They fled the 1991 Gulf War in a major exodus to the kingdom. The majority of them are residing illegally in Jordan, and they don't carry any residency or work permits. Last year, the Jordanian government started a major campaign to look for and deport all illegal workers. Now the war is giving hand to the government in carrying out this mission. Many Iraqis heading back to Baghdad said they were enraged by the footage of their relatives and fellow Iraqis killed and tortured in Iraq. Abdulrahim is another Sunni Muslim Iraqi heading home.
I don't feel that I am a man if I see my brethren killed and stay here. I can see on TV that the war is not as short as the aggressors had predicted, and I am sure we will win this war and save our homeland.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees had set up a special camp near the Jordan-Iraq border to accommodate Iraqi refugees. But no Iraqis have arrived at the camp, which was designed to host at least 10,000 people. Analysts believe many opted to stay home because the battles have not intensified yet. Others believe that not many can afford the very expensive means of transportation that can take them the 375-mile highway from Baghdad to the border. His bus packed with Iraqi returnees. Iraqi bus driver Nasser acknowledges a major, quote, victorious return, unquote, for the Iraqi youth going back to Iraq.
All of them are going back to defend their homeland, families, and dignity. If they don't have any weapons, they will fight with knives, with rocks, and with anything so that they will defeat Bush.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ola Farawati in Amman, Jordan.
From the human cost of the war to the economic cost, today President Bush asked Congress for almost $75 billion over the next several months to fund the war with Iraq and anti-terrorism matters at home and abroad. He spoke at the Pentagon earlier today.
Yesterday, I informed the leaders of Congress of these spending requests. The situation in any war is fluid. I reminded them of that fact, and so I'm asking Congress for flexibility in how these funds can be allocated. They heard that message. They also heard the message that the need is urgent. The wartime supplemental is directly related to winning this war and to securing the peace that will follow this war.
We spoke with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Binsky for a little analysis.
First thing to note about today's $75 billion request from the Bush White House is that the money is supposed to pay for just 6 months' worth of funding in this open-ended process of worldwide military domination that the Bush administration has the United States engaged in. This $75 billion comes after $400 billion in the regular budget that the Bush administration sent up last week for a budget resolution from Capitol Hill. Second, it's important to note that of all this money, now $475 billion, only $2.5 billion is supposedly dedicated to aid for the people of Iraq in their supposedly newly liberated state. Iraq is a country of 26 million people whose economy was largely dysfunctional anyway due to 12 years of United States brokered economic sanctions and Saddam Hussein's corrupt despotism. The inevitable destruction of Iraq's already fragile infrastructure that is currently underway, despite the Bush administration's claim to be using humanitarian military tactics, will also cost untold billions of dollars to repair. For example, these supposedly humanitarian tactics have already turned off the water supply to the second largest city in Iraq, Basra, with 1 million people, and can be expected to cause even heavier damage in Baghdad as the shelling and bombing of that city with some 5 million inhabitants increases. It's also worth noting that the White House says the temporary $75 billion is an affordable request, constituting just 1% of the United States gross domestic product. While this might have been true in the boom years a few years ago, it's certainly not true now. In fact, the $75 billion will push the current United States deficit to almost $400 billion, a level at which the United States would risk severe economic sanctions were it a member, for example, of the European Economic Community. That group regards any deficit over 3% of GNP as dangerous and destabilizing to an economy. This may explain why Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve System, has quietly visited the White House 3 times in the past few days, but has issued no public statements afterwards. It's also perhaps why the Bush administration is now making relatively little noise about its request for an additional $726 billion in tax cuts. Those tax cuts heavily benefit those with highest incomes, but are supposed to be an economic stimulus for the United States' faltering economy. But that huge and increasingly destabilizing tax cut is still a part of the Bush administration's congressional budget presentations. It was passed in a non-binding budget resolution last week in both the Senate and House. It's also worth noting that today's $75 billion six-month request does little to answer state and local complaints that they're being asked to institute more so-called homeland security measures, but they're not being given the money to pay for them. States cumulatively now have about $80 billion in deficits themselves, yet today's supplemental budget request earmarks just $2 billion for state aid. And then there are the usual slush fund aspects of the Bush supplemental budget request. An unspecified amount would go to the CIA and other clandestine services, which keep their expenditures secret, supposedly for security reasons. There are payoffs in today's request to Turkey, Pakistan, Israel, and Jordan, supposedly for their cooperation in the Iraq attack, and there's even taxpayer money flowing to countries that have no visible connection to the Iraq invasion, like Afghanistan, the Philippines, and Colombia. In short, this is just an opening bill from the Bush administration and what will doubtless be a long series of invoices for its worldwide militaristic adventures. But with the mindset on Capitol Hill currently reflecting what members of Congress believe is widespread public support for the Iraq invasion, today's $75 billion request can be expected to encounter little open opposition as the White House asks for it to be passed by Congress within the next 2 weeks. I'm Larry Bensky for Peace Watch.
Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky, you're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. ¶¶